it was suggested that we talk about is the subject of tshuva, the mitzvah that applies at this time of year, which is the mitzvah to correct mistakes that you've made in the past year, in the past in general. We've been over some of the technical details on Sunday evenings, and there we have a discussion forum, and Mitzvah next Sunday we'll also look at it again, maybe in more detail, but not everybody at this in this group comes to that group, and we would be guilty of discussing things that are less important and leaving out the most important thing if we discuss the philosophy of Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur and we didn't discuss the mitzvah itself of how you correct things that you, how you actually go about correcting mistakes that you made in the past, both in your own personality, your own interaction with the world, and in relationships that you have had with other people. So there's a mitzvah to correct damage, to undo the past, to go back into the past and undo damage that's been done in the past. We did say last night that we discussed it this evening, so make no apology for boring anyone who's completely familiar with all the details. If you're completely familiar with all the details, I'm not offended if you leave, or if you have nothing to correct. Before we discuss what I'd like to do with your permission is look at a few minutes of background to this issue on a slightly deeper level, and then look at the details of how you actually go about doing this. Not just a general sense of feeling sorry. There are steps that one has to do to actually eradicate from one's personality and relationships the mistakes that one made. So first of all, before we get to the technical details, try and be sure to leave enough time to cover at least the most basic essential requirements. And as much time as we have, we'll try to see more detail. Before that, let's look at the general area where this mitzvah is located. See, the remarkable thing here is that a person has the opportunity to actually go back and recreate situations or recreate parts of one's consciousness, one's personality, that may have been very badly damaged by mistakes that you made when you were weaker. There's a process you can do that could make a person stronger, so that if you were ever put back in that situation again, this time you wouldn't make the same mistake. It means that you've changed yourself essentially, intrinsically, not the same person anymore. That's miraculous. That you could actually change who you are on many levels is miraculous. First of all, there's a deep tradition, Kabbalistic, find it explicitly also, tradition that it says that Hashem created the mitzvah of tshuva before the world. That means before He created the universe, He created this potential that a person could sort of override what they've done and end up in a situation as if they'd never done it. That's a miraculous thing, that person could run time backwards and eradicate the damage of things that a person had done. But the Baalei Mussar explained that it's miraculous even just in plain straightforward personality terms, that a person could have suffered a certain experience, that suffered the damage of a certain experience, caused the damage that a certain experience caused, and then they could change themselves. That action actually is miraculous. In fact, it says quite clearly that if a person would change one trait of their character, and if you're given to anger and you really bring that under control, it's nothing short of miraculous. So the fact that it can be done means that there is the potential for miracles to occur. But a person shouldn't think it's easy. One of the most difficult things, maybe the most difficult thing to do, is actually change the base of your personality. Let's try and study some of this idea together. The first thing a person should know is that the Torah requires a person to gain the control to change radically the way you think and the way you, deeper than think, the way your knowledge of the world functions, the way you relate to the world. The Torah requires you to make an effort and to reach mastery. In fact, that's actually what you're here for. The first object of being here is not to make a living or to cope or to have fairly successful relationships. The overall definition of the first prime reason that we're here is actually to mold or change our personalities. And that's the most difficult thing that there is. not a peripheral effort along with other things that you're doing. Many of the Torah authorities say that what we call tikkun amidus, which means fixing up your personality, taking characteristics that are not there, that should be there, ones that are negative, that shouldn't be, ones that are channeled in the wrong direction, and changing them to what they should be, that's actually the purpose of Torah. That's the purpose of being alive, of being Jewish. And it's tremendously difficult. It requires an intensity, a concentration. It requires a focus on what's happening to my personality all the time. Tremendously introspective intensity that is very difficult to maintain. And one of the hardest things, if not the hardest thing that there is to do. Let's just look as a brief introduction just at some of the elements of difficulty. One element of difficulty that's particularly pertinent at this time of year to focus on is that we're so resistant to change, we're so resistant to changing our personalities that we tend to get into a situation, we tend to get into a mode of being, and then we find it impossible to break out of that mode. We get so addicted to whatever mode it is that we're functioning in that we can't break out of that mode and change. We carry with us the negativity of what happened at the office, or your day of yeshiva maybe. You carry it with you you bring it home. And exactly the wrong parties become the victims. They find it very hard to switch from one mode to another, from one environment to another. But switching from one mode to another is what it's about. There's a description of Yoav. Yoav was David's general, David HaMelech's military general. He's described in Tanakh in words that refer to him as a very hard kind of wood and as a worm. Soft, very soft like a worm. Mephoshim explained because he was a man of such strength, such inner control, that when he was in the Beis Medrash learning Torah, he was like a worm. That means he was as soft as he could hear the other person's point of view as well as his own. But when he was on the battlefield, he was like the hardest wood that there is. He had the ability to apply the appropriate facet of his personality in appropriate situation. We're unable to do that. That's one of the greatest weaknesses we have, is we apply the wrong facet of our personality in exactly the wrong situation. We don't have the control. One of the most prominent weaknesses in our personality is not having the control to switch gears from one mode to another. The commonest way this happens, the two ways in which this happens commonly, one is when we get into a habit pattern. We function in a certain way, we get into a certain pattern of habit, and then we can't break out of that. And many vested interests in it. One is it's too hard to change, another is that it would mean admitting that you were wrong, that you've been functioning in a pattern that hasn't been correct, that you sort of accepted as being what your life was about. The longer you've done it, the longer you've functioned negatively in one way, or you fail to function in a certain area, maybe, the harder it becomes to snap out of that mode. There's more of an admission that you were wrong, and more of an acknowledgement of the pain that you caused by having functioned in that mode and haven't not even thought about changing from it. It says that, for example, it says that when a person's judged, Rosh Hashanah, judged in the next world, person actually is happening all the time, when a person gets judged, so it says quite clearly, it says, Oy lanu miyom adin, and Oy lanu miyom ateichacha. That's very interesting. That means, woe, oy, that means woe is to us. That means we have what to fear from the day of judgment, and we have what to fear from the day of rebuke. So the Mephoshim asked the question, what does it mean, din? What's yom adin, the day of judgment? What's yom ateichacha? What's, ateichacha means, we translate in English as rebuke, but it really means, nochiach in Hebrew means to prove, a day of proof. What does that mean? What kind of judgment is there besides the day of judgment? What's the day of proof? And Briskerov explains, and many others explain this, and I'm warning you, this is heavy, is like this, that you get judged on two levels. You are being judged on two levels all the time. One is, you get judged on the level of what you should have done. Objective standard. You can be held to an objective standard, what the Torah requires. You broke this law, you broke that law, you didn't fulfill this, you didn't fulfill that. But there's a much more potent judgment, much more agonizing judgment, that has nothing to do with the statutory requirements that one was faced with. And that is, you are judged by your own standard. You see, the day of judgment, Yom HaDin, means when they say, look, the book says this and this and this, you didn't shape up to the book. There is a judgment that's very painful there. But there's a worse judgment when it says that the book didn't say this, but you said this. You said this and this and this, and you didn't match up to what you said. You set the standards. And that punishment, that judgment is much more awesome than what the book said. Because what the book said, you can always claim you didn't take it that seriously. You didn't know. You weren't brought up to understand. You know, I didn't tell you about that law. That didn't explain the punishment. You'll have what to say about the book. But you won't have what to say about what you said should have been. If they say, how come you wore shatness? So you'll say, I never heard of shatness. Shatness is the mitzvah that you're not allowed to wear wool and linen mixed in your clothing. Yes, you'll say, you'll be able to say you never heard about it. Of course, now you have heard about it. But the point is, that kind of thing, and you'll get away with that if you, to a certain extent, depending on how comfortable you were. But when you say, you go around talking about how negative it is to drop a friend, rather than what loyalty means, and what a relationship should be, and I should never let anyone down, and so forth, and how hurt you got when somebody did, well, then they're going to roll past you the video of the times that you did that. And then you'll have, that's what it says. It says there's a book that's opened, and the hand of every person writes in that book. There's nobody who speaks against you. The next world, our concept of judgment in the next world, is just you, that's all. There's nobody else, and there's no one judging you, there's just you. But you exposed to yourself. No, Tzadok HaKohen says one of the most amazing things. He says, it says that a book is open. That's what it says on the day of judgment. You know, there are three books that are opened. Book of the righteous, the book of evil people, and the book of the intermediates. And so, what is this book exactly? What is this book that they open? So Tzadok says, it's your heart. That's what the book is. It says, Kasvem al luach libecho. Write them on the scroll, or write them on the tablets of your heart. That's where the Torah is written. The book that they open in the next world, it's not a book. You picture, you get up there and they open this heavy book that creaks open, and then you see a mystical handwriting. That's not what it is. Your heart is exposed. That's where it's written. The writing that's engraved is on the text. The text that's engraved on your heart, that's what's exposed, and it's what you wrote. There is no way to turn. It's not that you'll be able to defend yourself against the accusation. You are the accusation. It's your pattern of behavior that's called tochacha. That's called proof, because it's, proof means being shown something that you can't deny. It's not the din that's thrown at you. Much worse is to be shown. And when a person gets shown their own activity, their own behavior, the way they overlooked someone else's pain or whatever it was in a relationship, and it's usually the closest ones where we do it worst, so then it's going to be enormously painful meeting of you with yourself. It says, when the brothers faced Joseph after 22 years of separation, they thought he was a wayward dreamer, they thought his dreams were ego, and they were very negative about him. 22 years later they faced him. They faced this leader of Egypt, this royal personage who'd been tormenting them, had been putting them through the most incredible crisis that they'd ever been through. And when they reached the point of coming to, being able to acknowledge, like when they reached the inner, the depths of their own personalities, when he brought them through that path, then he simply said to them, Ani Yosef, I am Joseph. When those words, the Chumash Mefoshim explained, when they heard those words, they were stunned, they were shocked almost beyond control. They couldn't respond, they couldn't move, they were paralyzed. Why? Because of the rebuke that they received by being told. What was the rebuke exactly? They were stunned as if they'd been shot by a bolt of accusation about how negative they'd been. What was the accusation against them? Which was the truth. That's all. It does not say that Joseph read out a scroll of their sins, that they were called to judge. I didn't say that. All it says is that Rechaim Shmuel Levitz explains what happened was this very beautiful idea. They judged him in a certain way. They were convinced about that. And 22 years later, they were still holding in that judgment, and they thought that the proof that they were right was the fact that he disappeared from the face of history. When they heard that he was Joseph ruling Egypt, which is exactly what his dream had said 22 years before, they suddenly realized that he was right and they were wrong. And that stunned them into an almost uncontrollable... Yes, that means the shock of... It's just the truth. Are we together? That's all. They were just exposed to the truth. That's all. The clarity of what actually had happened, where their mistake was. It was almost unbearable for them. It says that Yitzhak, the great Isaac, Yitzhak Avinu, it says that when Esav, when his son Esau, whom he had misread, he thought he was the one, he thought he was prime prior to Yaakov, he thought he was, he misjudged in a certain way at his incredible level. It says when that error was exposed to him, when he saw that Esav actually had sold the birthright and the brochas, and he actually was a very negative character, and actually Yaakov was the one, when he realized the misjudgment that he'd made of his sons, it says, Vayecherod Yitzchak vayechrat charada gedoyla ad me'od. He trembled with a trembling that was exceedingly great. The Foshim say ad me'od means very, very great, means even greater than the trembling that had faced him when he was on the altar. When he was bound on the Mizbech and he was about to be shechted, so a tremor ran through him, right, at the idea of transitioning from this world to the next, the fear of death. This trembling was greater. Why? Because being killed is one thing, but seeing that you were wrong, seeing that you misjudged in a critical area, that trembling was greater. It means that the greatest ordeal that faces a person was simply being exposed to what you are, what you should have been, what you could have been, what you are. That disparity, that's what judgment's about. The skill that's needed is the determination, first of all, and the study of how to do it, and building the strength to be able to change from one mode to another. From not carrying over one dysfunctional mode, either of habit or of vested interest, not just habit, but because you told yourself that this was the way to be, and you were unable to change it, so you carried on functioning in that way, is the skill to be able to change from one mode to another. There's also a self-destructive yetzer, a special inclination that attacks a person that tries with all the energy at your disposal, which means that your whole personality goes into a self-destruct mode at the least desirable times. And you can't get out of it, even though you know what it's doing. And even you see how dysfunctional it is. Insight into the problem doesn't help. Classic situation, I mean, you have it in so many ways. In the yeshiva world, you have a young yeshiva man. He's sitting in Kola learning Torah, and his wife, let's say she's not feeling well at home, she needs a bit of help. So he sits there wondering if he should go home and help her, or he should stay doing this idealistic task of learning Torah. And you could substitute for that a person at work, a person doing something else, whatever it is. Then he says to himself, and he's agonizing and he's feeling guilty, that the usual pattern is, it makes no difference what he decides, because he's going to mess up either option. If he stays there, what's going to happen is he's going to feel so guilty and be such a heel for not being home helping his wife who really needs it, that he won't concentrate on what he's doing at all. Right? Make everyone's life around him a misery, and he won't put his mind to what he's supposed to be doing, so he achieves neither. Of course, if he goes home to help her, he makes her feel so guilty and so low for being so weak that she needs him around to help, of course, that she wishes he wasn't there. That's the way we are. We usually, whichever one we do, we carry over the wrong mode into that activity, and we achieve neither. The power of being a Jew, what you're supposed to do, you're supposed to decide what Hashem wants from you right now, and to the best of your ability to decide, and do it thoroughly. You're carrying out Hashem's will now. We get caught in the double bind, so we're paralyzed into doing neither. But of course, that's not what's required. That's the test that you're being put through, is to make a heroic decision. And once you make the decision, you have to realize that this is what Hashem wants from me. I once heard an amazing description of an event that happened in Gateshead. I heard this from Rabbi Miller. There was a chassan and kala at a Sheva Brochus, and the Rav of Gateshead at the time was standing in front of them and saying a Dvar Torah. He was making a speech to be Mesamach the chassan, a very happy event, and while he was talking to the bride and groom, he suddenly had a tremendous chest pain, and it was the beginning of a massive heart attack from which he didn't survive. So he managed to finish what he was saying and make his way out of the room, and as the door closed behind him, he collapsed. And some of the Bochrim who were present followed him outside. They realized something was wrong, and they saw him collapse outside, and they tried to resuscitate him, give him the kiss of life, and they were trying to bring him back. They were trying to resuscitate him. And what happened was this. Inside the room was a singing and dancing of a Sheva Brochus. Just on the other side of the door was a man dying. The people who were trying to resuscitate him would try as hard as they could, and when they got tired, they let someone else take over. They went back inside and started singing and dancing for the Chassan and Kala. Okay? And that's what they did. They were rotating like this for a long time. Each person would go out and do his best to resuscitate a dying man, and then he would come inside, and as the door closed behind him, he had to snap into a mode of the mitzvah of being the Samach Hassan and Kala, that mitzvah on this side of the door, and that mitzvah on this side of the door, and they had to maintain that self-control, switching from one emotion to the other, like that continually, until they couldn't do any more. That's what's required. Sometimes Hashem requires that you switch off one mode, no matter how bad or difficult it is, and switch into another. I mentioned this recently in front of one of the rabbis in Johannesburg, who has a large community. So he said to me, do you know what it's like? When I said that, he said to me, do you know what it's like to live through a Sunday in my position? Do you know what it means? At 8 in the morning, I'm at a bris. At 9, I'm at a funeral. Right after that, I have to put up a tombstone. After that, I have to go to I'm at a chasana. After that, I have to say a few words at a bar mitzvah, and then I have to go to a shiva house where somebody's just died. And then I and that's what I have to do, and I have to switch. Yes, sometimes with no more than a minute in between, I have to switch from one emotion to another, and I have to function that way because that's what the mitzvah requires. I can't put on a face. I have to be it, and I have to feel it. Remarkable thing, a person doesn't always realize that. The rabbi walks in to your simcha and he wishes you don't understand that he's just been with people who've been torn apart 2 minutes before. Right? The people are literally being torn apart right now, and he's going from you to somebody sitting shiva, he's going from that. But that's what's required. That kind of control is what's required. It's not functioning one way or the other. It's the control to function correctly in each mode. Sometimes a person has to know how to be hard and resistant. Sometimes a person has to be soft and giving. Sometimes a person has to be some of both at the same time. Sometimes you have to react to more than one person, one in one way and one in another way, all at the same time. And we almost always get it wrong. With those who don't count, we're soft and wonderful. And those who do count, we're tough and bitter. Ask any lady who's been married more than about a week. It's very easy to talk about these things. It's very hard to do it. Even once, very hard. Very hard. And once you've laid down the pattern, it becomes much harder. Greatness is being able to say, love means being able to say you're sorry. Let's discuss now, there's much more to say about the subject, about self-control as it's required in changing from one mode to another, but let's be sure that we cover the basics of the mitzvah. Let's study together the classic source of this, which is the Rambam, who lists the requirements for tshuva. Right? In other words, you walk away from here on a Monday evening, if we've studied together something deeper that opens new facets or windows on the personality, that's all fine, but it doesn't begin to compare to having learnt practical halacha so you could actually go out and make a difference, right, in the practical world. And the mitzvah of tshuva is a mitzvah that applies at this time of year of changing from one mode to another, namely from a mode of having suffered damage back into a mode of purity that was the condition before you made this damage, and picking up life from there. It's never too late to do that, even if there's only a few minutes left of life. It's never too late to go back to any stage, no matter how far back and how much damage has transpired since then. So let's go through the practical details. So the Rambam says the following thing. The mitzvah involves three stages. Let me try and be as clear as possible. I'm going to say what's involved, and then we'll try and go through each element. Right? If things are not clear, we wish to ask questions, then I would suggest that you could listen to a recording of where we went through this in more detail, or you're welcome to come the next time we meet, where we will, Mr. Shem, try to be able to have a dialogue also. But I want to be sure tonight to get through the main details without leaving out any basics. There are three things that need to be done in the mitzvah. Let's try to be clear about it. First of all, if the person did something wrong involving another person, then it's not so simple. That's much more difficult. We'll get to that afterwards. But assuming that the sin that you did not involve someone else, it was just you, not between you and Hashem, as we say. You ate food that you shouldn't have eaten, it wasn't kosher. You broke Shabbos. You did the kind of thing that's a breakdown in the relationship between a person and Hashem, but did not directly hurt another human being. Actually, it's not true, because everything you do wrong to yourself actually damages everyone else too. But nevertheless, at a primary level, we divide these mitzvahs into those that are between you and Hashem, you and yourself, as it were, you and Hashem, and you and other people. You and other people, there's much more stringent requirements, much more problematic. Let's start with a basic form of tshuva, which applies to what a person has done wrong in and of themselves. Of course, when someone else is involved, you have to go through this too, but there are prior steps that you have to do. What you have to do is a mitzvah that's called vidui. Vidui means confession. There's a mitzvah to confess what it is that you did, not in the same way. There are other religions who also talk about confession. It's a directly learned out from the Torah mitzvah. It says it openly in Chumash that a person has to confess a sin that they did, except they have many details that we do not follow. Let's try and understand. Let me state the three elements of the mitzvah, and then we'll go through them in detail. The elements are confession of what a person did, regret for having done it, feeling and expressing regret for having done it, and taking on never to do it again. That's it. Now, the person does those three elements, it completely eradicates what a person did, for most sins. There are others that require doing tshuva and living through a Yom Kippur. There are those that require doing tshuva, surviving through a Yom Kippur, and suffering. Right? The person has to undergo a certain amount of suffering that comes their way. And there are some, to be specific, one, that is so bad that you have to do tshuva, which then hangs in the balance until you survive through a Yom Kippur, which all hangs in the balance until you undergo some suffering, which all hangs in the balance until a person actually leaves this world. When they transition from this to the next is when it finally, the tshuva finally takes effect. Of course, you have to do tshuva. That's a prerequisite for all these different types of avaras. You dare not die without having done it, because that would be a waste of the only opportunity that you get to die. You have to do tshuva first, so that whenever that happens to a person, it will have the required effect. But there are many sins that one atones for immediately on the spot. Immediately. You don't even have to wait. No suffering, no Yom Kippur. Immediately, they fixed up. And others, one has to survive through a Yom Kippur, one has to suffer, which happens anyway. Let's go through these three elements. In halacha, they called vidui, which is the center of the mitzvah, confession. Charoto ala avar, which means regret for the past. And kabbalah le'asid, taking on for the future. Those are the three elements of the mitzvah. Let's try and go through the three elements in very practical, without philosophical background. If we have time, we'll try and look at it more deeply. But first, let's be sure that we go through the practical requirements of the mitzvah. The Rambam phrases it in one sentence, and you should write this down, and if you don't, you should look it up and make a little card for yourself until you memorize the words, because he formulates this in one sentence, all three elements. So if a person will memorize this formula and they can repeat this to themselves whenever necessary, then you can be sure, you can be guaranteed of having covered all these elements. And I'll tell you his words. The words he says are as follows. If you wish to look it up, you'll find it in the first few lines of the first paragraph of Hilchos Tshuva in the Ramban. It's been published in English also with commentary. You can certainly look it up there. And he says as follows. This is what you say. Now, let's just say the words, and then we'll try and take it apart in detail. The words are as follows. You say, Ana Hashem. This is much more potent in Hebrew, by the way. But it does not have to be done in Hebrew. It can be done in any language, especially if you're davening with a minyan, especially Rosh Hashanah Yom Kippur. Those 10 days are much more amenable to this. But it can be done at any time in any language, although Hebrew is much more potent. You should know, by the way, that Rosh Hashanah is a time of judgment for the whole world, not just Jews. It's not just a Jewish event. All humans are judged equally on Rosh Hashanah. The words are like this. First of all, you say, Ana Hashem. Ana Hashem means, there's no way to translate it in English, but it means the best you could do in English would be sort of, please, Hashem. Ana does not really mean please. It's an untranslatable expression of longing that doesn't really have an English word. But that's how you open up. And you address the creator of the universe to remind you that you're not just sort of saying in front of, you know, the vague sort of cosmic emptiness that this thing that you did was wrong, but you are aware that there's someone who defined this thing as wrong. And that's why you start off addressing the source of existence. You say, Ana Hashem, and then you say, Chatasi Ovisi Pashati Lefanecha, which means, I've sinned in front of you, in three different ways. Let's look at that more carefully. The in front of you means that this thing that I did wrong was wrong because you say it's wrong. That means, had it not been in front of you, had it been in front of my own sort of social consciousness or my conscience, etc., that would really be irrelevant, right? It's because you exist and you define this as cosmically wrong that I feel the pain of having done what I did. And the three words you use in Hebrew, again, we don't have words for them in English, but what you mean is that you sinned in three different degrees. You did something wrong that you may not have been so aware was wrong, or you gave into temptation, let's say. Secondly, you did it deliberately. That's a much more serious category. Knowing it was wrong. Despite knowing it was wrong, you did it anyway. And thirdly, you did it rebelliously. That means doing it because it was wrong. Now, that's by far the worst. That's because you weren't allowed to do this thing, you did it. Right? You specifically took pleasure in the fact that this thing was forbidden. And there's a special perversion in the human mind that enjoys things dafka because they're forbidden. It says, Maim genuvim yimtaku. The stolen waters are sweet. And of course, Mephoshim point out that even water is sweet. Water doesn't have any taste, but when it's stolen, even water tastes sweet. We have that problem. Those are the three elements that a person did. In almost everything that you did wrong, there's some of all of those three. Right? So you say that. Now you've set the scene for being ready to confess. Yes, you're now aware of exactly whom you're speaking to, and exactly not how bad the thing was, and now you say the elements of what you did, and that's called vidu. You say, Va'asisi kach v'kach. I did, and then you fill in your own cadenza, you fill in your own relevant piece, right? I did that and thus, you fill in there what it was that you did. We'll come back and look at the details shortly, but that's where you stipulate and you say, you express exactly what you did. After you say what you did, which is the heart of the mitzvah, the Torah says you shall confess your sin, then you say, V'harei, which means sort of, behold, harei, nichamti uboishti b'maasai. I regret what I did. Nichamti means I regret it to the point of wishing I'd never done it. If only I could go back there, I wouldn't do it this time. Uboishti means I'm ashamed of these things that I did. Rambam includes the feeling of shame in a feeling of regret. Rabbeinu Yonah in Shaarei Teshuva lists 17 requirements for teshuva. If you really want to do this mitzvah properly, don't only have three requirements. He lists shame as one of 17 requirements. And this is not a luxury, this mitzvah. This is a mitzvah that people have to perfect. So I would suggest that you get a copy of Shaarei Teshuva, which is certainly translated with a facing English translation. You can work through that book and you can go into great detail, a whole book on the subject of how to perfect each of these elements. However, despite the fact that there may be 17 elements to teshuva, these three are the basic requirements without which the mitzvah doesn't live. These, you can't do less than this. Not more you can do and you should do, but at least these things you have to do. So you say that you're ashamed, you regret, and you're ashamed of what you did. And the final component, taking on never to do it again, you say, I will never return to this thing again. But that's it. One sentence, takes you 5 seconds, and you have eradicated the thing that you did wrong. Let's look at these aspects in a little more detail. First of all, before we look at the words, let's understand the intention. Okay? You have to think a certain thought while you're doing this. And I'm pointing this out because in most other mitzvahs of the Torah, you do not have to think the right thought. I don't know if everyone's aware of that, but we discussed here under the heading of Root Forces, where we discussed how the mystical world is connected to the physical world, and you referred to that the recording of that discussion if you're interested. We try to explore over there the idea that most mitzvahs work in such a way that if your mind is empty at the time you do the mitzvah, or you're thinking of something else, right, it does not invalidate the mitzvah. The mitzvah works by making sure that your physical body does the right action. Very few exceptions to that. There are one or two exceptions, but very few. Of course, it's not ideal, and it's the lowest way in which you can do the mitzvah. But if you do the action, then the spiritual circuit, let's say, is closed and the lights come on. Of course, you could do much better, but the minimum required is to do the correct action. However, there are one or two mitzvahs where you must have the right intention also. Again, let me not mislead. With most mitzvahs, you do need to have the intention that it's a mitzvah that you're doing. I do not mean to say that if you accidentally, yes, if you're lounging on the couch, reading something secular, and you happen to absentmindedly pop a piece of matzah into your mouth, and it happens to be Pesach, you are not fulfilling the mitzvah of leaning and eating matzah. Right? You have to have the intention, at least, that you're eating matzah now because it's a commandment to do so and it's Pesach, right? But Kabbalistic intentions of what it does in the higher world and the purity that you want to generate and ideas of spiritual freedom and so forth, don't have to have that. Just the simple intention that you're fulfilling the mitzvah. However, there are one or two mitzvahs where there are exceptions. The mitzvah of teshuva is an exception. You cannot just intend to mumble specific words. You have to mean that you're sorry. You have to mean that you wish you hadn't done it. You have to mean that you won't do it again. If you don't mean this, not only is the mitzvah invalid, but you just committed a new sin, namely of lying to Hashem through your teeth, and you need a new teshuva to atone for that. So therefore, if one's not holding by teshuva, then one definitely shouldn't do it. Unlike other mitzvahs, where you hope one day to get to the level where your mitzvah will be better, and you try it at the most basic level now, teshuva doesn't work that way. Are we together? unless you really feel it, you dare not say it, because you are achieving exactly the opposite. So with tshuva, the main part of the mitzvah, although you have to say the words, the main part is genuinely feeling the regret, because the idea of the mitzvah is changing who you are. You have to so regret it, so intrinsically, so deeply, that you definitely wouldn't do it again. And saying the words is not going to do that if you don't feel it. Are we together? That's where the easy part of this mitzvah is saying the words. It's one sentence, you can whip through it. The hard part of this mitzvah is building yourself to a level where you're exposed to the same temptation again, you wouldn't do it this time. That's the hard part. As I mentioned before, there are even mystical explanations that the reason that you get off without being punished, if you do tshuva correctly, is simply because of the fact that you meant it so intensely that you aren't that person anymore. Try and explain this. Some commentaries ask a question: how could you be forgiven for certain things that you regret doing if the damage of the action is still in the world? Let's say a man and a woman had a forbidden relationship. That's the example the Rambam gives. Now, because of that relationship, let's say a child is born. Let's say it was a married woman, married to somebody else. Now, the child has got a certain spiritual nature in the world. Now, let's say the parents do tshuva, and they regret ever having done this thing wrong. But the damage is still in the world. They're still accountable. How can they escape accountability for something that is an ongoing reality in the world? So there are a number of mystical answers to this. But the one that we want to understand this evening is this. The reason that they escape judgment for it is not because they've undone the damage. The damage is there, but they aren't the people who did it anymore. You see, you've so undone your consciousness, you've so eradicated the person who did that thing, that when the cosmic forces of punishment, let's say, come to identify and punish, exact punishment from the person who did that, they can't find that person anymore because the person doesn't exist. The fact that that personality inhabits the same body is irrelevant. You're not judged for your body. You're judged for what's inside your body. And if what's inside it is not the same person anymore, are we together? It's a wonderful understanding. The reason that they can't pin it on you is because you've changed the dress spiritually. You just aren't there. You've changed identity. Fantastic idea. The hard part of that, the good news. The bad news is that you really have to change identity. You can't mumble the words while you're the same old person. You have to really change who you are. That's the hard part of the mitzvah. But if you really change who you are, you have internal cosmetic surgery to the point that the feds can't identify you anymore, or whatever they call it. Then you're just unrecognizable in the spiritual world. You're a new person. And that's why there can't be exact punishment from this individual. On the contrary, in fact, there are certain sources that say that you get rewarded for the sin. You hear that? You now get rewarded for the sin, because the sin that you did is what brought you to this point. The essential element in having reached this purity and perfection now is the fact that you made that mistake. So, of course, if you do it deliberately, if you make the mistake deliberately in order to grow through it, then you block the path of tshuva. It's one of the exceptions that you can't. If you say, well, I'll do it wrong so that I can then work on myself to get to the, so then it doesn't count. Right? Those are one of the few exceptions. But if you did fall, and you now were sensitized to who you were by seeing that there was a weakness in the fiber of who you are through that error. And now, yes, it's like a machine where the crankshaft has a microscopic crack. Now the engineers don't see the crack. Now under stress, when that engine is working under stress, the shaft breaks. So now what they do is they weld it in such a way that the welds could be stronger than what it was originally. It will never break again. So in other words, what saved this machine was the fact that it broke. The fact that it broke down once is what ensured that it will never break again. Yes, there's a brocha in that. And the engineers will be happy that it broke down then so they could... That's the idea. And therefore it says that if you do tshuva for the right reason, you do tshuva out of love of Hashem, not out of fear, you do it out of love, then the act that you did deliberately wrongly will be turned into merits, into mitzvahs, as it were, because you have used them now to reach a level that you haven't reached before. It's an incredible idea. So that is with regard to the intention. Now let's go through the details of the specific elements, like this. First of all, vidui, confession. Confession means vidui dvarim. You have to speak out with your mouth the elements of what you did wrong, right? You are not allowed to say it in front of anyone else, but unlike there are systems where a person is required to confess to another human being, we're not allowed to do that. Not just not advised, not allowed to, because there are many sources that say that it's a disgrace to the king to go around saying what you did that was a dishonor to him that other people should hear. If you really are ashamed, you wouldn't want anybody to hear what you did wrong. If you're really ashamed of it, you try to keep a measurement of the degree of shame is how much you try to hide this thing from other people. And therefore, if you are going to someone else to tell that person, that is not an indication of shame, and therefore you keep it very private, you say it only to yourself. However, the words must be said loudly enough that you can hear. That means you have to form the words with your mouth. That's the din in tefillah, by the way. Some people make that mistake. While they're davening to Hashem, they sort of scan the words and think them. That does not fulfill the requirement of davening. You have to say the words with your mouth. You have to literally form the words, at least loudly enough that you would be able to hear them. You have to do that in any language, and you can do it at any time you wish. The best time to do before I say that, let me say this. There are exceptions. There are one or two types of sins that a person has to confess in front of other people, namely where he did those sins in front of other people and needs to make amends. If a person did something wrong in the community and the whole community suffered, maybe he might have to get up in front of that community and openly say that I regret having done this and that and the other. However, that's a frighteningly difficult thing to do, and you could lead to all kind of problems by doing it, and therefore before you do that, you should certainly do it in private, and you'd need to ask a knowledgeable halachic authority if you think you have such a particular kind of a problem that needs to be confessed in public. But the general rule is that you certainly don't confess in public, you confess on your own. What is a good time to do it? Any time, in any language. But best if you can do it in Hebrew, because it says that that gets through directly instead of through intermediaries. Much better if you can do it while a minyan is davening. While a minyan, 10 men, are davening Shmoneh Esrei, whether you're a woman or not, irrelevant. Well, the gates are opened by that. And if you can be present when a minyan is davening, behind the mechitza, then you can say your vidui at that time. You should daven together with them, and when you reach the end of Shmoneh Esrei, you should then put in your own personal confession. You can put it in during as well, but a very good way to do it is at the end. I don't want to go into too much detail. If you look in a good siddur that has good English translation, like those, the brown ones that you see over there, art scroll siddur, you'll see that at the end they've got very clear instructions for this. I don't know if you've noticed, at the end it says, at the end of the Amidah it says, Yiyu l'rotzin, then you say a little piece, davening for purity of speech, that's in the singular as opposed to the rest, and then you'll find it says, Yiyu l'rotzin again, and there in English is a little instruction, some recite verses pertaining to their names at this point. At that point you should put in the verse that is the pasuk, that's your name, which everybody has a verse in Tanakh, and if you're aware of this, that begins and ends with the letters that your name begins and ends with, you should say your verse there at that point, so that now you're registered that you're here. It's not just you started with Avraham, Yitzchak, and Yaakov, but now you want to put yourself into that chain. And then, after you've introduced yourself in that way, you then speak out your own piece. And it can be in any language, and if you do it at that time, certainly doesn't have to be in English. It's equally good in another language, and you can continue davening even if the minyan's gone home. Right? As long as you started together with them, then that is a very special time. Between Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur, by the way, if you do it with a minyan, then the Rambam writes that it's equally powerful even at any time of year. If you feel the need to do this and you go to shul when there's a minyan davening, it does not have to be Rosh Hashanah Yom Kippur time. However, if you want to do it as an individual, then it's much more potent at this time of year. There's another good time to do it, and that's every night before you go to sleep. And there's another kind of tshuva that a person should do to sort of cleanse themselves in general before they die. And that a person should do all the time, at least once a day, because since you don't know when the end will come, so you should always have that action of cleansing complete. And we'll try to find time to speak about this as well this evening. If there isn't, then we'll try maybe to do it next time. Let's look at the other elements of the mitzvah. The regret for the past works as follows, that you say that you wish you'd never done this thing, and of course that's where you really have to feel it. You have to feel it so intensely that when you say it, and then you say the part about that you'll never do it again, you have to mean it so intensely that if you were back in that situation again right now, exactly in the same situation, you definitely wouldn't do it again. That's the test of whether you've been sincere or not. The ultimate acid test is to be back in that situation, but you're never allowed to do that deliberately. In fact, one of the tests of whether you're sincere about your tshuva is how far you keep yourself away from that area. Never mind not wading into danger, but how far you give a berth to even vaguely coming close to that area. And therefore, one has to feel intensely when you say that, that you definitely wouldn't do it again if you were in the same situation. Only you yourself privately really know if you've reached the level where you wouldn't do that again. And sometimes you can't even be sure, but only Hashem really knows. The problem is that there's really no way you could ever be in that situation. He says the only way a person can know if they've completed this mitzvah successfully is as follows. He gives the example of a man who sinned with a woman, and he says if that man would ever be with that woman again, and he puts it as follows, in the same place, exactly in the same place, exactly in the same way, feeling exactly as he did about her then, feeling the same way. And he puts in so many requirements that it's impossible really to picture ever being back in that situation, because even if you could approximate the same situation, you wouldn't be as young as you were the previous time. It wouldn't be the fact that it was a new experience before, and so forth and so on. Therefore, it's quite clear that a person never really can be in the same situation. But that's not what's meant. What's meant is that you have to reach a level where if it would be possible, you wouldn't do it again. Or if you could dream up an equivalent, that this time you would be able to hold strong because of the tshuva that you did. Not because it just isn't attractive anymore, or because of realizing through the act of having worked it out and so forth, that is a complete tshuva. With regard to the confession, there is another aspect also, and that is that one should say as much detail as possible. When one confesses in vidui, you shouldn't just refer to the area in general. You should speak out in great painful detail every aspect of the thing that you did wrong. Right? All the details, the planning that went into doing wrong, what you did wrong, which was a sin, the thoughts about it, which was sinful, every detail of enjoyment that you shouldn't have done that you did get out of it, the regret for having desensitized yourself in that way, for having hurt the other person if there was another person involved, all the effects and the ripple effect, the secondary and further effects that came out of what you did, they all have to be worked out in detail. You have to regret each one. Because you have to, if you think about it, it's logical. What we're trying to do here is change one's personality. One's personality was faulty in all those different dimensions. It could be that sometimes a person did a sinful thing because they exposed themselves to harmful, let's say, material, not entertainment material or whatever, that got them thinking in a certain way that eventually led to something wrong. So then you have to go back to the root of what it was. And the reason you have to do that is so that you avoid that experience in the future. It's not, yes, you have to avoid, you have to short circuit the whole chain at its root. And therefore you have to focus on all the details. In the heat of the sin itself were many elements, and each of them has to really be confessed and regretted. The only exception to this is where you start going through the details and you find that you are enjoying them. When that happens, then you are probably not regretting it anymore at that point. Even though you started out sincere, but right now, yes, you sort of trail off into a lengthy fantasy about exactly what happened, and you actually forget that you're busy doing tshuva. What then happens is that you have now chalked up another debit, right, that you have to do tshuva for. And therefore, not that funny. And therefore, if that's the case, and it often may be the case, then a person should skip over those areas and just refer to them in general. The last thing you want on Yom Kippur, when the mind tends to wander anyway, is to be sitting there probably looking where you shouldn't be in the first place, trailing off into detail, right, about something that you did that you started off sincerely trying to regret. That's not the way to do it. And therefore, in such cases, you should rapidly refer to the area, leave it to Hashem's imagination, and go on to the next area that doesn't pose this problem. That's obvious. Those are the basic requirements of the three elements of tshuva. Now, this couldn't be simpler. You can easily remember them as past, present, and future. Present is confession of the sin itself. Past means going back and regretting the fact that you did it. And future means resolve and statement never to do it again. Before we move on to the next area, let me just make one thing clear. And that is, when you say you won't do it again, you're not expected to be prophesying that you won't do it again. That's not what's meant. You have to be clear about this. Does not mean that you can categorically prophesy that you'll never fall into the same error again. That's not the idea. What you mean is that right now, the way you're holding strong in your tshuva, you would not do it again if given the same opportunity. That is what you mean. You're not prophesying that you won't. And that's very important, because sometimes what happens, many people will tell you that they sincerely try to do tshuva, and every time they do it, they then go into a... they then fail again. They do tshuva sincerely, and the next week or month, they then make the same error again. And that is a very disconcerting experience. The way one should relate to that is as follows. You say sincerely that you won't do it again, meaning that you make every effort to keep away from it, and if you were there now, you wouldn't do it again. If you then fail, you do tshuva again. You do not have to worry that your tshuva was insincere when you did it. If it was sincere, it achieved its effect. Now you weakened when you were faced with that situation or similar one again, so you have to do tshuva again. There's no question about it. That's the way you have to handle it. If, of course, you weren't sincere, if you were saying you were sorry when you weren't sorry, then, of course, you're guilty of another avera, like we said, and that you shouldn't do. Finally, some people ask the following question: what happens if you really regret it? What happens if you're really sorry, but you are aware that you will do it again? Unfortunately, that happens often. So there are many mepharshim who write like this: even the feeling of shame and regret is valid and achieves a result. And therefore what you should do is like this. You should say, Hashem, I'm ashamed and regretful that I did thus and thus. I'm confessing that I did such and such. I feel terrible about it. I wish I hadn't. And I feel ashamed for having done it and not having had the self-control. But I must be honest with you, I'm probably going to do it again. Yes, if that's the best you can master, then you have to say that. At that point, you ask Hashem to help you not do it again, and you ask Him to help you get to the stage where you'll be able to be strong enough not to do it again, and you show that you're sincere about it by not getting yourself into danger in that area again, to the best of your ability. But you don't lie through your teeth and say you're not going to do it again, when despite you hating yourself for it, you're busy planning how to do it again. That's the way one should relate to that situation. Let's spend a few minutes studying the area. You have more energy? You're not sure? You have a few minutes more energy? Let's study together for a few minutes the very difficult subject. If you think what we've been discussing up to now is hard work, what's coming is much more difficult, and that is where the sin involved another person. Where someone else was damaged, right? Where you transgressed a law of the Torah between yourself and someone else. You let someone down, you hurt them, you harmed them, you used them, you showed disloyalty, you stole in some way or other. Let's understand what you do. First of all, there's another subject that we don't have time to go into that takes a great deal of study. You have to know what you did wrong to other people. Many times we don't even know. Waking someone who's sleeping, for example, is halachically theft. There's no question about it. That's definitely considered stealing. You have to know that. And not only that, but it cannot be given back. Now, it's a more difficult form of stealing because you can't give back that thing. Of course, this doesn't apply if the person asked you to wake them or they needed to be woken for a certain thing. But if you just, you have to understand. We do many things like that. Sometimes you damage something, someone's house, and you say, oh, I'm very sorry about that. That's not good enough. You have to buy them a new one, pay it back, unless they specifically exempt you from that. Many things that we do. That we don't understand. Take your child, visit your friend. While you're sitting and talking to your friend, your child takes the house apart. Because your child hasn't been given a Torah education, which involves short, sharp shocks occasionally. And then as you walk out and the house has been flattened, you say, kids are kids. Kids may be kids, but Rosh Hashanah is Rosh Hashanah, and judgment is judgment too. You have to pay the person for the damage that your child did. When your child over bar mitzvah, you don't have to pay. You just leave the child behind. You sell the child as a slave to the person. Right, so what do you do if you committed a sin with another person? Right, against another person. So here, there are two requirements that come before you can do tshuva. And it says absolutely clearly in the Gemara, it's quite explicit, that tshuva doesn't help at all on Rosh Hashanah, Yom Kippur, until you have appeased the person, until you've made up the damage and gained their forgiveness. it's useless and completely false to stand in front of Hashem and confess and so forth and so on when you haven't tried to right the wrong that you did to that person. And the requirements are twofold as follows. Before you do tshuva, you first of all have to make up the damage, and secondly you have to gain the person's forgiveness. Okay, those are the requirements. Let's try and study them a little bit more in detail. Making up the damage is much easier. Right? It does not say anywhere that the person has to know about it. If you could look back into some sort of account, funds that are missing from that account, or if you could in some way make up the damage so that they're not any longer suffering, this is where they don't know about it. I'm talking about where they don't know that they ever lacked it, if you can get back to them. Now the requirement is to make up the damage. That's the requirement. When it's money, it's easy. Sometimes it's not easy. Right? For example, if you spoke Lashon Hara about somebody, you said something quite true about somebody that you shouldn't have said. Now you're in trouble, because the person to whom you said it has a lifetime negative image of this person that you said it. Even if you try and correct it, you'll probably not be able to eradicate it. It's a very, very tough thing to undo. Or where you implied something about somebody's character in some way, and they didn't make that marriage that they would have made had it not been for your comment, or that employment unfairly, or whatever it is, very, very hard to undo. But nothing, let's say this, the good news is, nothing's not amenable to tshuva. Everything can be corrected, but some things are harder than others. And therefore you have to try and make up the damage. Where the damage is financial, if it's an individual, then often it's easy to make up the damage. Sometimes it's very hard. For example, if a person cheated people in business over a period of time. Unfortunately, that can happen. A person can shortchange people, they can do things that are not quite honest in business, and then a few years later when they start getting involved in a more Jewish way of life, how are you going to find those people whom you shortchanged? In fact, a man came to me some time ago and he said as follows. He said, look, I've been getting involved with Osamach and I've been coming to Shirim, and I now understand something that I never understood. I have been cheating people for years. Okay, I've been short, undersupplying and overcharging people in my business for years. Okay? He hastened to tell me that he wasn't doing any worse than everybody else is doing to him. He was doing what's completely standard practice in his field, you follow? But the point is that that doesn't make it right. Now how is he going to undo this damage? He can't begin to trace all the clients that were involved over the years. Right? And not only that, if he has to put together the funds and make a conservative assessment of the funds that were mishandled in this fashion, now there's no way he could begin to afford to make up the damage. Not a pleasant situation. Not a pleasant situation. If those who were wronged are Jews or non-Jews, it makes a difference too. It makes a difference too. In some ways, there are leniencies with non-Jews. In some ways, there are tremendous stringencies with non-Jews. Because with a non-Jew, it can be a chilul Hashem also. It can be that he sees you as having done this to him because you're a Jew. In which case, you're guilty of a chilul Hashem. A chilul Hashem, it says, the only way to atone for is tshuva, suffering, Yom Kippur, and dying. Right? Not prematurely, but when it happens. So what does one do? Let me say in general that all these situations it can be corrected, and if a person has a particular question in one of these areas, they should approach a knowledgeable halachic authority who can answer how one should try and make amends for such a situation. I'll just to give you an example to show you that it can be done. The Poskim write that if you cheated many people and you can't find them, then one thing you can do is take the money that you gained illegally, even if you do it over a period of time, and you do something for the community with that money, even if you can't find the individuals. Because what will happen is those people will indirectly benefit as members of the community that you have now benefited, or at least their estates or descendants in some way, right, which should have inherited the money that was illegally derived by you. Which means that you are doing a sincere effort to make amends, you are not using those funds anymore, and you're trying to get them back to the source, right? It doesn't even have to be a religious end, it can be just a community benefit, that there's tangible benefit to those people in one way. It's not perfect, but certainly is the way to handle that situation. There are also ways to handle even more dismal situations, which I'm frightened enough already, I'm certainly not going to it. What happens if the person that you wronged is not alive anymore? Now how exactly do you make up the benefit and get forgiveness from that individual? The Rambam writes quite clearly and openly in Halacha, there are certain things you can do at the grave of that person, but at risk of what we don't want here is lines of people traipsing into the cemetery to perform these, and therefore I'm not going to go into detail, but again, if you're worried about this, you can certainly ask a halachic question and you can be given an answer how to handle these types of situations. So the first rule is you have to make up the damage and pay back whatever it was that you owe the person. The second part, and much more difficult, you have to get the person's forgiveness. Okay? They have to be meichel you. They have to explicitly forgive you, right? At least in their hearts, even if they don't say it to you, but you try to extract from the person an explicit forgiveness that they no longer hold it against you. Now that is often a very, very difficult thing to do. But let's spend a few minutes trying to study this. This is not frills or fancy bits. You have to do this, right? Without this, the mitzvah is completely invalid. You can't make up the damage. And the punishment for things you did to other human beings, in many ways, is much worse than punishment for things you did to Hashem. And therefore, a person has to face up to this and do it. Let's try and discuss how one goes about this. So like this. There are two categories that one has to consider. Firstly, where the person knows what you did wrong. And secondly, as often happens, when the person doesn't really know what you did wrong. It often happens. Even in close relationships, they're not really aware of some awful thing that you did that was disloyal to them or hurt them. Or they're not aware of the extent or the details. Now, let's try and go through this. If the person knows what you did wrong, it's much easier. If the person knows already they have a problem with you because of this thing that they heard or found out about or suffered directly, then there's no two ways about it. You have to go up to the person and say to them, just grit your teeth and face up to it and say to them, look, this problem that we have between us, I want your forgiveness. Here's the way in which I'm making it up to you. I want you to know that I'm destroyed by it and I just can't handle it and I want you to forgive me for having done this thing that I did to you. Right? That's what you have to do. If you cannot face doing that, let's feel this out a little bit together. First of all, what happens if the person refuses to forgive you? Or what happens if in your assessment they're unlikely to forgive you? That often happens. So then you have to do as follows. First of all, you should know, the Rambam writes, that if a person refuses to forgive somebody who asks them, it's considered cruelty. And if they refuse long enough after sincerely being asked for forgiveness, it becomes their avera. You follow? If you just cannot bring yourself to forgive, and you keep refusing the person cruelly when they need your forgiveness, then it becomes your problem and they're not obliged to ask you anymore. So a person definitely shouldn't be cruel. One of the three hallmarks of the Jewish personality is not being cruel. Right? Having innate shame is one of them. Having an innate desire to benefit others is a Jewish qualification. And cruelty is a specifically un-Jewish. That means if you have cruelty in you, if you really have a trait of cruelty, you should sincerely doubt that you come from Jewish stock. That's what it says. And therefore, one has to find it in oneself not to be cruel and to forgive the individual. But if the person has been so badly hurt that they cannot forgive you, then you should ask friends to go and see them and implore the person on your behalf. Your friends, their friends. You should write them a letter, fax them, whatever is needed. Right? Bombard them with your attempt to get them to forgive you. If at the end of a series, a whole process of doing this, they still will not, then there's nothing you can do, and you leave it and it becomes their problem. The only exception is if it's your Rebbe. If the person is your Torah teacher, whom you wronged, and will not forgive you, then you have to keep going back and back and back and back, and there's no way out. Until he sees fit, until he understands as a Torah teacher that you've gone through what you need to go through, and he then forgives you. But except for that, you do it in that fashion. Now, what happens if the person does not know what you did? Some of this discussion overlaps. I'm going to handle it under this heading, although some of it applies to the previous category as well. What happens if the person doesn't know that you did this thing wrong to them? Right? So now, what do you do? So now, there's a very deep and amazing argument among the halachic authorities as to how you handle the situation. Let me try and be clear about it. One opinion is that you have to go up and face the person and tell them what you did wrong. You have to announce to them that you did this and this and this, and you acted behind their back, thus and thus, and whatever it was, and you spell it out in detail. It's an enormously difficult thing to do, but you have to do it. Not everyone agrees. There are those who say you can ask the person's forgiveness without telling them what you did. Alright? Let's try and explain that. Everyone agrees it's much better to tell the person. There's no question. Some say it's essential, and some say it's not essential, but it's better. So if you can find the courage to face the person and tell them, there's no question that is much better. However, if you don't have the courage, or various other reasons apply, and I'll try and be explicit, then you can ask their forgiveness without saying what you did. Let's try and study the subject. First of all, sometimes with the best intentions in the world, you just cannot muster the strength of character to go up to the person and tell them what a low thing you did. That happens. Secondly, and often, what happens is you are worried that the person won't forgive you. They may be a gentle, wonderful, forgiving type of individual, but when they hear what you did to them, they will not speak to you again. They may become violent. They may transgress a number of sins through finding out. For example, they may now bear a grudge against you, which is a Torah prohibition, and they may take revenge against you, which is another Torah prohibition, and you may have caused them now to transgress these two sins. Are you following me? By telling them what you did, you misassessed this person. Instead of carefully assessing that they would not forgive you, you just blundered into it and told them, and now they don't forgive you, so you didn't achieve anything. Secondly, they bear a grudge, they take revenge, you lose a friend, you ruin a relationship. There are all kinds of problems that might happen. In that case, it's advisable not to tell the person what you did, right? And what do you do? Two things. In some circumstances, you do not say anything about it at all, okay? For a number of reasons. Again, you cannot make your own decisions in these areas. You have to ask somebody halachically qualified who can weigh it up for you. What's recommended is to go to a halachic authority and say that I have a friend who did this and this and this and this, and my friend asked me to ask you what to do. Probably the rabbi will say, if it bothers your friend so much, why didn't your friend come and ask? Anyway, the point is, that is what you say. The situations in which you do this are as follows. The Chofetz Chaim and Rav Yisrael Salanter, there was a debate between them about this. Chofetz Chaim said that in order to go to Rosh Hashanah Yom Kippur free and unburdened, you need to ask forgiveness and clear it. Rav Yisrael Salanter said, what right do you have to upset this individual so you can feel cleansed? Here's this person who doesn't know that there's this problem. Now you want to go into Yom Kippur clear and cleansed and pure. So you walk up to this person and lay on top of them the most abysmal story of what you did to them. And now you go into Yom Kippur cleansed with it off your chest, and they're burdened down by the most enormous pain that you call, that you cannot do. That's not Torah, that's not Musa. You take the pain of being uncleansed and let them be happy. That's what Abishol said. Anyway, there's an approach like that. There are other reasons also. One of the classics is, and I wish this weren't so common, but unfortunately it's very common, is where an adulterous relationship took place. Right? What happened was a married woman had a relationship with a man other than her husband, and now this man becomes a Baal Tshuva and he wants to do Tshuva. Now he wants to go to the husband of the lady and he wants to ask forgiveness because of what he did. Now, there are a number of problems there. First of all, you may not survive. Okay? Secondly, she may not survive. You may not be forgiven. You may wreck a marriage. You may wreck more than one marriage. And there are many problems associated. There are halachic authorities that say there are many, many problems. This is not the subject now, the time to go into detail, but just to illustrate it, one of the problems is that if a man thinks that his wife committed an adulterous act with another man, then even if he doesn't have any proof at all, but if he's convinced about it, he's forbidden to her, and she's forbidden to him. Okay? Let me try and make this clear. It's not tonight's subject, but very briefly. If a couple have an adulterous relationship, then the couple become forbidden to each other forever, that woman to that man, and she becomes forbidden to her husband forever because of the betrayal of her husband, right? That's permanent and forever. Even if the person's not Jewish, it makes no difference. If the person's not Jewish and would later convert, she's still forbidden to him. That's the law. Now, that only applies, of course, where there are witnesses. We can't make judgments like this in Torah. In fact, there's a death sentence attached to such a thing, right? Although we cannot execute that nowadays. But the point is, it's a very serious crime, sin. That, of course, applies only where there are witnesses, in detail, detailed witness. However, there's another law which says that if a man believes that his wife did such a thing, even with no evidence at all, and even if he's wrong, he is forbidden to her, right, from then on. Okay? She's not forbidden to him, and she's a perfectly kosher woman. We can't make any judgments about her status just because he believes something. But since he believes that it's true for him, are you with me? There's a law in the Torah that says that if you say this food's not kosher, even if I know it is, you may not eat it. I can eat it, the food's fine. But you can't eat it because of your... Are we together? And therefore, if a man thinks this about. So now you may raise that problem also. Here's a husband trying to build a good relationship with his wife, and they're trying to make up for mistakes they made in the past, and therefore she's not forbidden to him because he does not exactly know what happened, even if he suspects maybe. But that's not it. But if you go and tell him and he now becomes convinced, so then they become forbidden to each other. So what did you gain in that situation? What did you gain? I remember once a man came to me and he said that his wife had had a relationship with three other men, at least three. My head was spinning by the time the story was over. Three other men, and he didn't have time to tell me what he'd been up to. The point is that now they were trying to put the marriage together, and they were trying to build a strong relationship. Now, he came to ask me, not for halakhic advice, but psychological advice. How does he get over the feelings of negativity? How do they build a strong relationship? How can they work on their marriage and make it beautiful, and so forth and so on? While I'm trying to advise him psychologically how to make his marriage work, I'm realizing that he's forbidden to her, right? On pain of death, you know? I mean, the capital crime that's been committed. What am I supposed to tell him? This man is not holding by listening to me tell him halakhically. He's just not... He walked into the shul to speak to me without a kippah on his head. I mean, he was holding completely and never even heard of these laws. So, he was holding in a world where these things are mitzvahs. Now, how am I going to tell him that he's forbidden to this woman? So I didn't know what to say. A few months later, I was in Israel, and I went to ask my Rebbe what I should have done in such a situation. I went to ask a great man, how do you handle such a situation? So I said to him, look, this man came to speak to me, and he asked me for psychological advice, how to build his marriage. So if I said that, he cut me short immediately. So very amazing, I understand the Torah mind, and he said the following words. He said, I'm going to quote for you what he said. Meaning, if you want to fix him up psychologically, tell him it never happened. Tell him, you hear this, tell him that women say these things. You follow? Tell him his wife never did it. She wanted to make him jealous because he wasn't paying enough attention to her. And so she wanted to make him realize that at least other men find me attractive even if you don't. And so she made up these stories. What actually happened was she looked at a man on the bus, that's all. You know? That's what he said. That's all. But I understood what he meant. What he meant was that you're not going to get out of the situation halakhically. This man's not going to listen to you. As long as this man believes this about his wife, then he's in trouble. But if you sow a seed of doubt in his mind, he's not forbidden to her. Anyway. I'm trying to illustrate the fact that there are some problems that if you go and broach the lion in his den, you may gain nothing at all, and therefore before you do such things, you certainly need to ask a halachic question. However, in most cases, you do have to go and ask the person forgiveness. And we'll just finish with this idea. There are strong halachic opinions, and I would personally very strongly recommend, my humble capacity, I would recommend that this is the line that a person takes. You go and ask the person for forgiveness without telling them what you did. Okay? The way you do it is as follows. You have to be very careful. But if you do it wrongly, then the person will assume much worse than what you did. If you go up to the person and you say, look, please forgive me. The person say, for what? So never mind. Just really. By the time you've managed to duck and dodge out of telling them what it is that you did, they will have built up an enormous fantasy about what it was that you did, and you're for sure certainly not going to get forgiven. And therefore, you have to be subtle and delicate about it, and what you do is something like this. You go up to this individual and you say as follows. You say, you know, it's almost Rosh Hashanah, right? And he says, yes. Say, you know, I've been going to these lectures. And he says, yes. And you say, well, I've been learning over there that it's a Jewish custom that before Rosh Hashanah Yom Kippur, we all ask each other for forgiveness. And let me say at this point that I forgive you for anything you may have done. I'm not saying that you did anything, of course, but in case there's anything that you ever did to me, I hereby forgive. Now, I would like to ask you if you could possibly find it in your heart to forgive. I'm not saying that, of course, I'm not suggesting that there's anything that I ever did to you, but just in case. No doubt, we've known each other for a long time. Probably somewhere in our relationship there was something less than perfect that I can't think of now. And therefore, I would ask you if you could oblige me by forgiving me for anything that I did. You phrase it something like that. You should know that there is a custom like that. Many people have the custom, especially within families where most of the problems really exist, to ask each other before Rosh Hashanah. It's a very beautiful way of doing it. Ask each other for forgiveness that anything happened. Everybody who lives in close relationship with somebody else treats them less than ideally. There's no such thing as a relationship where perfect respect is maintained all the time. There's no question about it. And therefore, that is our custom to do that. And therefore, that's the way you say it. There is a problem, and the problem is how can they be sincere if they don't know what it is that they're forgiving you for? That is a question, but you can take it from me. There are great authorities who explain that it's not an obstruction to the forgiveness if it is sincerely given. That means if the person really means that they forgive you for anything that might have happened, they mean that, and they can afford to mean that because they're not feeling negative. Since they, you follow, they're not resenting the thing itself, since they don't know that they can afford to be large and magnanimous about it, and therefore they mean it. And if they mean it, yes, there's one latter-day commentary who says that it's like signing a blank check. If you give someone a blank check and you signed it, the check's valid. The fact that they put in a much greater figure than you sort of had in mind, the check is valid. It will go out of the account. You with me? And therefore, that's a vague analogy to this idea. The way to understand it, if you want to understand it on a deeper level, is as follows. We understand that when a person forgives you for anything you may have done, very often the process a person will go through is like this. I hereby forgive this person, even if they did enormously bad things against me, and in your mind go various terrible things that they might have done, but of course you don't believe that they did any of those particular things. And since you're not threatened by the pain, you follow, you can really genuinely forgive them for that. If you knew what they did, you definitely wouldn't be able to forgive them. But it's not because you don't want to, it's because you now so emotionally involved with, do you follow the problem? But it doesn't mean you're not being sincere now. You might think this is a bit of a Londisher knetch, but it works, and if it's the only way you can do it. There is a precedent for this in Halacha, and that is that the Rambam writes quite clearly in Halacha, when a man has to give his wife a divorce that he refuses to give, I'm sure you're aware, the Halacha is that if a man refuses to give his wife a get that she needs, the halacha is that we beat him, right, until he expires. We beat him to a pulp until he gives the get, right? The problem is that he has to give it willingly. The problem is he has to give the get. He has to give her. A gun to someone's head, coercion is not considered a valid halachic act. So the Rambam writes incredibly, we beat him until he says, I want to. That's what he says. So the commentaries ask as follows. In fact, the Rambam himself writes like this. What do you mean you beat him until he says, I want to? Of course he doesn't want to. Of course when he's giving it, he's saying, I want to, because his life's in danger. He's in with an inch of his life. Says the Rambam, the most incredible, unbelievable spiritual principle. He says like this. We are here trying to induce this man to do a mitzvah. To give his wife a divorce that she needs at this point is a mitzvah. The Jewish neshama wishes to do mitzvahs. He really wants to do the mitzvah, but his lowly vested interest and his all the concreted layers of negativity on the outside of his personality are preventing him from doing this mitzvah. So you beat him until you smash his yetzer hara out of the way. And what you left with is a pure Jewish neshama that really wants to do the mitzvah. The Rambam's not writing jokes, that's what he means. That means that when a person is in that extreme situation, what comes out is a remarkable, remarkable thing. Anyway, that's a vague analogy to this idea. And therefore you can approach the person and you can ask them for forgiveness, and if I give it to you, then the forgiveness is valid. Let me end with two things. First of all, I would hereby ask anybody to forgive me for anything that I might have done in the course of relationships with them that were less than ideal, maybe advice I gave that wasn't ideal, or maybe things I said that caused people to be upset or depressed, or any other thing that I might have done, and I'm not saying there were anything, and I said, right, you all forgive me, right? I didn't see everybody know. There's no one here that I have to forgive for anything, but if you want it, I'll give it. Secondly, let me say that tshuva is not the only mitzvah, and I just want to mention it so you don't think this is the complete picture, and I'm not going to go into detail, just to mention that if a person is worried that they may have a decree of, God forbid, death or something terrible over their heads for the next year, then it says that there are two other things that you need to do along with the tshuva in order to try to avert that decree. Of course, if there's no decree over your head, you should do these things even more strongly, because it's much easier to prevent a spiritual illness than it is to cure one. So you're certainly not exempt if you think you're in the clear, right? But whether that exists or not, the two other steps are tefillah and tzedakah. That's what it says. Tefillah, tzedakah, tshuva, tefillah, tshuva, tzedakah. Those things avert even a decree that's already signed can be put aside. Tefillah means davening, prayer. You ask Hashem to spare you and to let you off and so forth. You actually pray about it with tears especially. Tshuva, as we discussed this evening. And tzedakah is a very special, not just another mitzvah. It is a mitzvah of giving charity that can actually save your life. There are very deep mystical reasons for this, and therefore a person should remember that. What it means, very briefly, at the risk of tiring you, just so that you can try and fulfill this mitzvah in the next 2 minutes, I'll tell you. Tzedakah means giving 10% of your income. Okay, that's an obligation. You must give 10, but not more than 20%. That's what one is obliged to do. Strictly speaking, you're obliged to do it even for the past that you didn't do. If you omitted this mitzvah, you need to start giving more so you make it up over the course of time. You need to give it to you need to give tzedakah as an obligation. That's why we have a custom on Shabbos, if a person has an aliyah, to say that you'll do it, so you fulfill it as something that you oblige yourself to. You should give more than 10% if you're worried that the minimum is 10% you have to give anyway. If you worry that there's a decree over your head, you can give more than 10%. In fact, if you're sincerely worried and you really want to save your life, you can give more than 20%. In fact, you can give away everything you have, although under normal circumstances you're not allowed to, because it says that if you give away more than a fifth, you may yourself become poor. However, if you're doing this as a life-saving technique, then of course you can, but at least the person, halavai, everybody should give at least 10%. That's what a person should do. You have to be very careful that you give it to a valid cause. There are many causes that appear to be valid that are not valid. Okay. First of all, some causes, I don't want to be particular, especially since this is being recorded, but there are many causes that seem to be valid Jewish causes. You can speak to me privately. They are not valid Jewish causes, or even if they are, there are many pockets along the way that siphon off percentages of what you give, so that by the time it reaches what you intend, very little of your money's worth is being had, if at all. You should give it to a Jewish cause. There is a specific mitzvah to give tzedakah to non-Jews as well, you should know, but Jews come first. Jews in your town come before people in your town, come before people in another town, with the possible exception of Jerusalem. It can be considered like every Jew's town. But apart from that, your prior prime mitzvah is to give to people in your town before others. If they're related to you, then they come first also. If you have a child who needs to be supported in yeshiva, that counts as tzedakah. That is not considered your obligation. It counts as tzedakah money. There are many expenses that you probably are doing anyway that may well count as tzedakah. You need to research them halachically. You should give the money to a cause of Jews who need it in your town. And let me say at this point that I personally have a tzedakah fund that many people give me money, and the money goes to two. I'm just making it easy for you. I'm sure you can find your own, but if I can be helpful, and you can channel it through me. Part of the money goes to poor Jewish families, and unfortunately there are more than a few of them, not necessarily observant or in Torah learning at all, but people who can't find enough to feed themselves. I don't give it to them personally. I wouldn't like to mislead you. I give it to somebody on whom I rely, who gives it to the families personally, and I personally give to families who are observant and are in Torah learning and are sacrificing their potential income to be able to keep up their idealism in Torah learning. Some of it I also give to yeshivas, including Osamech, and you certainly can do that yourself. If you support a place like Osamech or any other yeshiva in Johannesburg, you're not only gaining the mitzvah of supporting families that need it, you're also gaining the merit of their Torah learning. It's not just the mitzvah of tzedakah, you're also buying a share in the learning of all those students sitting in that yeshiva. Osamech right now has certain projects that they're hard-pressed for certain funds. You can certainly channel it through me, and I'll be happy to channel it. Let's sum up like this, that we're talking here about life-saving activities, not just mitzvahs. There's no such thing as just another mitzvah, but in this case we're talking about directly life-saving activities at a time of year where we desperately need it. We're not in good shape, we're not in good shape in general, and you see it reflected by the world around us in general. If we were in better shape, the world around us would be in better shape too. Unfortunately, we're not in good shape individually either. Sorry to have to tell you that. If you're an exception, you'll apologize for my saying so. But most of us are not at all in good shape as individuals. And we haven't even begun to realize what it is that we could and should be doing, let alone have started doing it. And therefore, what's needed is a focus on these various components of these various activities. The work that has to be done is to convince yourself that you can change gears. you can change from one mode to another. You don't have to hold over your old habits and your old negativity from one mode to another. If you need to bolster yourself with outside information, you need to get it. Yes, it does say that if you give tzedakah, you'll never get poor because of that. It says if you give 10%, you'll become rich. That's what it says. It says that if you wish to test Hashem in this area, it's considered a mitzvah. If you need that stimulation, you need that inspiration, you're allowed to do it. You're allowed to hand the money over and say explicitly, Hashem, I'm testing you. In fact, many authorities say it's a downright, it's a mitzvah to do this, although in other mitzvahs you're not allowed to do it. I'm testing you, I want to see this money come back manifold. You're allowed to do that and expect to get it back. It's not a lonely thing to do. It's considered to be an act of emunah. Yes, you can do that. There are many ways to inspire yourself about these various activities, and that's what we have to focus on now. Is from Elul to Rosh Hashanah, is gaining the strength to change gears in our personality and not have sticky, negative, rusty holdovers from patterns that we've developed. We need to become convinced that we can become new, and Rosh Hashanah should be the focus for becoming entirely new.